We're going to try to entertain you for the last session. I know it's going to be the last session, certainly not the least interesting of this conference. It's a pleasure to be here. I think it's been a fantastic opportunity for the past day to actually listen to the richness of the insights of different conference that you've been hearing. And we've been hearing from a different perspectives on food security. We've heard a lot about natural resource management. We've been hearing about food safety, about trade market. We've been hearing about funding mechanism and the potential of public-private partnership to contribute to these efforts on food security. I think that the next session is going to be a very interesting session also, which provides a slightly different perspective on food security, which is trying to provide a second perspective on food security. And I'm not going to take much time to try to discuss or to introduce a session. I think that what we want is to give as much time as possible to the different presenters to actually come and present you with the content of the presentation. The format that we'll be using is going to be the same as the one that was used in the past days. Each of the presenters will have 15 minutes to present one after the other, and then we'll call all of the presenters back in a plenary to try to respond to your questions. As we start, I just want to try to quickly highlight the fact there has been a slight change in the program of that session. We had 5 presenters that were originally in the program. The last two presenters in your program, Dr. Beatrice Wanjiru Kingoli, and Don Clement Sudharma Emankanta will not be able to be with us today. But Beatrice Wanjiru Kingoli has been replaced by Festus Muriti, who will be presenting on the VM. Without taking more time, I would like to try to introduce the first speaker to the panel. The first speaker is Paul Wilson. Paul Wilson hails from a farming background near the English Lakes District. He obtained first and higher degree at the University of Newcastle upon Tyne, and he went to take up an lectureship in agricultural management and economics at the University of Nottingham in 1995. Currently, Dr. Wilson is an associate professor and director of the University of Nottingham Rural Business Research Unit, and his primary research interest centers around agricultural and food economics and sustainable agriculture. I'm not going to go deeper into that. Dr. Wilson, please.
Okay, well, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here and talk to you at this conference. I'm going to be presenting some work that really is work in progress. And it might be considered slightly tangential to food security when we look at it from the outside and initially. But actually, I think it's the kind of work that is becoming increasingly important that we consider in a food security context. Because I'm going to be talking to you about some work that we're doing looking at second-generation biofuels. And I was particularly drawn to the conference title that you have here in terms of food security risks, threats, and opportunities, because I think biofuels in themselves present potential threats, clear risks, but I think that the type of work that we're doing might also present some opportunities in a kind of roundabout way. So why are we all here? Well, we've heard a lot about the problems of food security, but one of the terms that's come into common usage within a UK context is this knowledge of the perfect storm, which our chief scientist, Sir John Beddington, coined, which is really about the population increase, environmental change, and energy running out, broadly speaking. And biofuels was initially seen as a saviour to part of this equation, but then very quickly it transpired that the world decided, or certainly parts of the world decided, that biofuels is actually a big threat to food security. Within the EU, we've got mandated targets for the supply of biofuels to be included as part of our energy supply. But some of those have been watered down, so to speak, from their initial starting point when the policymakers actually discovered that biofuels were not a golden bullet. And a lot of the focus is on liquid biofuels in terms of getting a biofuel into the transportation sector in a readily available manner. So a little bit of background. First generation biofuels has obviously got a big focus at the moment. A lot of ethanol is being produced largely from corn. In the UK, it is wheat and sugar beet that forms the feedstock for biofuels. And that obviously brings forward some conflict with food supply, although there are animal feedstock possibilities from the spent product of first generation biofuels. But the work that we're involved with in the UK is partly to do with this second generation biofuel push, so looking at lignocellulosic fuels, apologies for the spelling error on my slide, and the Biological Research Council funder within the UK, BBSRC, has recently invested £27 million UK pounds, so that's 40-something million Canadian dollars, to push on this second-generation biofuels. And but from a second-generation biofuel perspective, whilst it's always a new technology, there is a public and policy difference in terms of the feedstock that's coming through from this technology. And it's important that we recognise that there are differences. And from a sustainability point of view, second-generation biofuels, some of those biofuel feedstocks are not necessarily sustainable, especially if you've got to plough up pasture land, which then releases carbon. So it increases greenhouse gas emissions in the very sort of cause of wanting to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. In terms of dedicated energy crops, so things like miscanthus and short rotation coppice are possibilities within the UK. The trouble with that is that we end up with land use change, more threats to food security. And the particular angle that we are looking at is to look at co-products, so cereal straw, but even that may have indirect land use changes. So to give you a little context of the UK, we've got 19 million hectares of land in the UK, and I was interested to learn that I think this is about the size of Alberta in terms of physical size. From that, we've got 6 million hectares of arable land, 3 million hectares in cereals, the majority of that is in wheat. It's quite high yielding, 16 million tonnes. And within a UK context, dedicated energy crops are minority crops, and they're going to remain a minority crop in our opinion, simply because of things like food security is driven up the price of wheat. And when you've got these high prices for wheat and oilseed rape or canola, then the drive from a farm level decision making point of view to actually push on dedicated energy crops becomes a lot less. So right at the bottom of this slide is a phrase that we're starting to use now, which is trying to define second generation biofuels within context and actually calling this technology that we're looking at co-product second-generation biofuels, because it's really thinking about dual-purpose crops so that we can produce grain and produce straw that might be applicable for biofuel production. So part of the work that I'm involved in is particularly looking at farm-level decision-making, and what we're doing within our farm-level decision-making work is to look at it from a context of energy production, energy in and energy out of the farm system, the environmental consequences of that, largely from a greenhouse gas emissions perspective, and then the farm-level financial aspects as well. And we're wanting to look at the trade-offs between energy, emissions, and effectively economics at the farm level. And on top of that, we need to identify barriers and incentives that exist in terms of farmers producing energy crops or using straw as a co-product. So the approach that we're taking within our research for the farm-level aspect is that we're using a somewhat traditional approach within an agricultural economics framework, in that we're using an optimization model to represent a typical UK farm, but we're developing that optimization model to look at the possibilities that we could maximise profit from our farm systems, we can maximise net energy, and we can minimise greenhouse gas emissions. And really the first two of those are the important ones, because if you decide to optimise a farm system for minimising greenhouse gas emissions, then it's quite a simple technology. You produce nothing, you produce no greenhouse gas emissions, but you've got no food or fuel. So what we're looking at is we're looking at a system where you've got land, rotational and labour and machinery constraints. We're building the optimisation model. It decides what to grow in terms of whether we're optimising for profit or for energy. And you come up with a crop mix, and you come up with the trade-offs that exist. And this is really useful if we're wanting to get this message across to policymakers as to what they might want to incentivise farmers to do. So just some results broadly on this screen. In the top left hand of your screen, this is a crop mix within the farm, and you can see there's broadly a big green patch, a big light blue patch, and then a big red patch towards the left-hand side. And this is typifying a typical conventional rotation in arable systems, where we've got a first winter wheat crop, then followed by a winter barley crop, and then followed by an oilseed rape or a canola crop, to establish the most profitable rotation. And as you increase the straw price, so a lot of about half of the straw in the UK is currently chopped and incorporated into the soil, the other half is baled and sold for animal bedding. But as that straw price increases, then the optimal crop mix would move to a very much continuous winter wheat cropping scenario. So when you get wheat straw prices up to about £80 per tonne in this context, double what they are in a typical year, then it would be optimal for farms to move to that scenario. In the bottom right-hand side of this screen, we've got three things going on. The black line is the profitability at farm level, which increases slightly as straw price increases. The red line is the net energy produced, which is fairly flat along this scenario. And then the blue line is the greenhouse gas emissions. And you can see there's a dip there just in the middle. And that's when you start to introduce legumes within the rotation. And at certain prices, the model chooses to introduce legumes. I could have put up many different slides. If I put up a slide showing you response to fertiliser prices, legumes would feature very heavily within the rotation as the fertiliser price increases. Your greenhouse gas emissions fall, but your net energy also falls and your gross margin fall. So that's one example of some of the results that we're generating. We've also looked at some fairly simple policy scenarios, and as I said, it's very much work in context, work in practice. But this is an example of what would happen if we were to introduce a carbon tax within a UK context. So you could introduce this on fertiliser, you could introduce this on diesel fuel and farm machinery. And what would broadly happen is that within this context, you would introduce more legumes within the rotation because it would be the most profitable thing to do. What would happen is you would end up reducing greenhouse gas emissions from farm level production because you'd get a crop mix change. One of the alternatives, of course, to growing conventional cereal crops is for farmers to grow these dedicated energy crops. And when you optimise this modelling framework to optimise net energy from a farm system, then it will grow a dedicated energy crop, miscanthus. This is a crop you plant, you leave it for a couple of years, and then you harvest it annually, and it has about a 20 to 25 year lifespan. But the trouble with this is that from a pure economics point of view, that it's not a very optimal thing to do from the farm level. And that if policymakers wanted to go down this route of incentivising farmers to grow dedicated energy crops rather than food crops, then the trade-off indicates that you would need to pay farms quite a lot of money, somewhere in the region of £280,000 for a 400-hectare farm, so roughly £700 per hectare. Vast amounts of money to actually incentivise them to grow dedicated energy crops. So, our initial starting point from this research project, which kicked off 2 years ago, was that we didn't perceive that dedicated energy crops were going to be the future in a UK farming context, providing fuel, and we still don't. Although it is likely to be part of the crop mix on some farms, possibly in more marginal arable areas. But even using straw within a biofuel sector is slightly interesting because farmers obviously use straw in terms of animal bedding. They also incorporate it into the soil and it adds soil structure and returns nutrients. So farmer attitudes are involved. And one of the things that we've done is we've conducted a survey of farms. We're asking 250 cereals, general cropping and mixed farm type systems about their straw use, whether they would allow straw to be used in a bioenergy production context, and what would happen if straw prices changed. So I'll skip over this slide and get through to some results. This is some very early data that we've got back. We're expecting it all back by the end of November. And we asked farmers about if they were to supply straw, what kind of contracts would they like? Because if we're going to develop a second generation biofuel sector within the UK, then we'll need to know that there's a guaranteed supply of feedstock coming through. And not surprisingly, farmers want a fixed price for their product, but they're also interested in prices that are linked to P and K fertilisers. so that they're actually being paid in terms of the content of the straw, because the P and K is what they're giving up. And in terms of the amount they would supply, largely they're interested in supplying a fixed area of straw. This is unlikely to be their total straw area, because within a narrower context, they'll want to be retaining some of that straw to incorporate back into the soil to provide soil structure benefits as well. And in terms of dedicated energy crops, in terms of this very small sample that we've got back so far, we asked them whether they would actually be interested in growing energy crops. The majority of them wouldn't. And in terms of short rotation coppicing, the reason that they wouldn't are largely to do with the land quality issues that it brings, the long-term financial commitment that's involved, and the time to financial return. In terms of Miscanthus, which is an easier crop to grow to some extent, the same things crop up, but also some people might be interested in it because of ease of crop management and partly to do with profitability. So there are some interesting technique takes on some of this, but some of the other comments that we're getting back from farmers are also that I don't want to grow energy crops, and I don't want to grow them not because they're not profitable, I don't want to grow them because it's unethical to do so in a world that's hungry, broadly speaking. So we're getting farmers in the UK coming back and commenting that they don't want to do it for that reason. So I won't bore you too much with the future work. We've got a long way to go with this project. It's part of a bigger project that the UK Research Councils are funding. We're going to be extending our work in terms of different farm systems and different crops that we're going to be looking at. But just to bring this to a conclusion, why do I think it's important that we're considering energy, and bioenergy in particular? Well, I do think bioenergy poses a big risk to food security around the world. This perfect storm is very much looming large. Certainly, all of the talks that we've heard in the last 2 days have very much reinforced that. And we do have a big problem. I've been heartened by presentations also in terms of some of the solutions that are clearly out there, particularly in terms of some of the things we've recently heard about in Africa. But at the moment, within a UK context, we don't see dedicated energy crops being part of the major solution. And these dual-purpose crops potentially are. And it's an important area for us to work on. And I'm going to leave you just with the final bullet point of this conclusion slide. But I think part of the reason that the developed world needs to focus in on this aspect to do with bioenergy and how we're going to drive people around the world is that I don't think we should be exporting our responsibility to the Southern Hemisphere. So rather than buying in feedstock or buying in fuel that's been grown within a Southern Hemisphere context where land may be precious and needed for fuel production, I think we need to take much more of a responsible attitude to it within the Northern Hemisphere and see what we can grow within our own resources, rather than relying upon the Southern Hemisphere to provide that fuel for us when their resources may be more productively used to produce food for themselves. So with that, I'll leave you and have you answer questions later on.